Hi, my name's Scott Cuthbert, co-founder of Safepedia, and I'm super excited to be back for our first official episode of Hearts and or Heart Hats and Heart with Sarah Bellini Ross. And we've got a special guest today. Sarah will introduce herself and the guest, and then we'll just dive right in. So, Sarah, take it away.
Hello there. Welcome to our second episode on Navigating the Innovation Journey, a Human-Centered Approach. We are so excited to have Bo with us today. Bo has been in the construction industry almost all of his life, and he's going to share his innovation journey of refining his tool and how he's brought a human-centered approach to refining his product and other solutions on the market. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the innovation journey and how we get to where we're going. Anything you want to add, Bo?
No, I'm just looking forward to, again, I thank you for your time this morning. And no, I'm looking forward to talking about the journey because that's what it is. It's a journey that really never ends. Just an evolution. So yeah, looking forward.
Absolutely. Thank you. As we talk about the innovation journey, I just want to provide a little bit of context for everybody to think about what is that journey if you're trying to tackle a problem. And that problem is the exact first step of the innovation journey. You really need to spend your time in on that initial stage of recognizing what is that problem or that need that needs to be solved. What is that problem statement or challenge statement? And as you kind of define that, that's going to give you some insight into how you can bring that human-centered design approach into tackling that problem. Once you have that problem really designed and really thought out well, then you can spend time with those end users, discover what is needed, what is their experiences, what are their pain points, what are their struggles, and that's when you can really dig in and figure out what is going to work for them. We have to figure out what's desirable, be able to find a solution that's going to work for them, and then figure out what we need to do to get there. And then once we have that all figured out, that's where we get to put the brainstorming into action. We get to get into that ideation phase where we get to generate all of those new ideas. That's where we get to think outside of our box, bring that curiosity to the table, and figure out how can we solve this problem with a new way instead of just trying to keep going, dealing with those dull, dirty, dangerous, monotonous tasks of our job. This is where we get to put on that thinking cap and come up with new solutions. This is where it's really important to have that diversity of thought in that process. You can't just have people who are so far removed from the problem in this phase, or you're going to end up with a solution that just doesn't really work for most people. Bo, how is your experience in defining your problem?
Describing my journey and what that's been like. Thank you. What I discovered in my early 30s was that the human body simply was not meant to work in certain positions for prolonged periods. That was evident to me because I was doing a lot of tile work at the time with my family's business. I just happened to be one of the three sons that was really good with tile. And so I somehow got that kind of handed to me. And we are a sunroom business. We built we're the largest sunroom builder in the West Coast for a period of about 10 years. And with those sunrooms come a lot of tile. And so I found myself in my early 30s, having been in the construction industry since 19 years old, always going hard, that in my early 30s, it started catching up with me, especially being in the static position of laying tile for 10 to 12 hours a day for 5 to 6 days a week. I remember times when I literally could not get out of bed, and I was 32. And so there was something wrong. And again, that's when it hit me that, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. I'm showing up early. I'm learning everything I possibly can. At 32, I had already given 13 years to a career that I was passionate about. And frankly, I started to feel a little cheated, a little angry, a little, just because I felt like you know, here I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, giving the best years of my life to something that I'm passionate about. And now my body's beginning to fail me right when I'm really have the opportunity to start making money. You know, I had a young family. I had four daughters. At that point, they were all in diapers. And it was kind of a scary moment because I realized that I didn't think I would. I started questioning whether or not I would be able to continue down that path of knowledge, wisdom, mastery of my craft when my body was failing me. I couldn't get out of bed. And so I was hit with a decision that I had to make. And I remember it vividly. It was Christmas Eve. I remember it because they didn't want me in their house. I was laying tile and I didn't want to be there necessarily, but, it was late. It was about 9 o'clock in the evening and it was a very large tile floor. And, I just remember pulling off the grout, looking at my arm, and I couldn't feel it anymore. I couldn't feel the fingertips anymore. My elbow had become numb. It was tingling. And I just remember looking down because at this point I had to have that arm down to support my body because it's the only way that I could continue to work. And it was right there that it flashed into my head that we're not meant to do this. I'm in pain. Why can't we have a third arm that is centered on our sternum that supports our upper body while we're engaged in these static positions? And it was like a flash of lightning that just came through my body. And I'm getting tingles right now because I remember it. And I remember the next day was a Saturday morning. I went to Goodwill. I bought a child's snowboard and I cut it up into what I saw shape of a chest plate. I put it in my oven and got it very soft. And then I created a contoured mold and I laid it in there. And then after about 3 minutes, it cured. And I was so excited because I had my very first chest plate. So anyway, that was question one. You get me going on this. The answer is fundamentally, I discovered that the human body was not meant to do what we are asking it to do in certain careers or positions and jobs. And I just thought that wasn't fair. I just felt cheated. And I felt that I needed to solve this problem for me first, because then you don't even think about other people. You're selfish. You think, hey, I'm in pain. I need help. So I built a weapon to fight back against pain. And that's pretty much it.
So your body really helped you to discover that problem statement. Your arm was that glaring thing that really showed you the need to be able to go through the rest of the phases. So once you had that spark, that was kind of your ideation moment. And then you shared a little bit about moving into the solution space, but really there's a couple key phases of that solution space for our listeners to think about. Your prototype development, you know, that first snowboard was kind of that initial tackle of your solution. And this is where you take those ideas and really transition them into tangible prototypes to be able to play with, to see, is this idea that I thought of on Christmas Eve, is this really going to work? Is this going to be a solution that can actually help the problem? And then usually once you're in this phase, this is where a lot of people iterate through lots of different designs, processes, and that's where you get that feedback from users. Is this comfortable? Is it doing more harm than good? Is it helping? Is it hindering? Is it getting in the way? And then as you refine that prototype, that's where we're able to kind of move into that testing phase, where you have a better device, where you're able to put it on more bodies, kind of get that insight. And then once you have a refined product, that's once we get into that implementation and scaling. You didn't go and buy 100 snowboards right off the bat, right? You started small. And that's a key thing to remember with your innovation journey. We need to start small, pilot, test, and refine, but also be okay to fail. So if you would have put on that snowboard and all of a sudden it would have created more pain, got in the way, kept falling off, you probably wouldn't have went back to the drawing boards and thought of something new. And that's a key thing to remember, right? We can't be so married to our ideas that we keep marching forward. We have to be willing to have that curiosity and that flexible nimbleness to be able to think differently. And then that's where we can really evaluate our prototypes and decide, is it ready to scale? Is it ready to be mainstream? Or do we still need more time? Can you talk about your prototype development process? So how did you go from the snowboard to where you are today?
Yes, thank you. The prototyping process, what I would say is that it's important that it be you that put your hands on the innovations. I had to learn how to weld. I had to learn how to sew. I had to learn so many things that are outside of the scope of what I would consider, you know, regular tasks or my job duties. It completely different. It was almost like arts and crafts. The prototyping, I'm a tradesman. And so that puts me, I can build things. If I can see it, I can build it. And I saw what I saw in my mind, and I was able to build it. Even before I would hand it to anybody, there was probably 10 iterations, even before I got to the point before I actually handed it to somebody. The funny thing is all along the way, if you were to ask me at that moment, is it there? I would tell you that, yeah, it was there every single time. But to answer your question about the prototyping, yes, I'll give you an example. This is that snowboard, you know, and this is the newest of the new backup. Okay. So getting back to the prototyping, you're talking over 40 different iterations, you know, probably 20 before I started handing them out. I remember it well was that, I went from snowboards, and this is when, again, you think you're finished. I thought I was finished. I thought I was finished when I went from snowboards to actually buying the plastic already cut in the shape of the chest plate. Then, of course, then you melt those, and then I thought I was done. I also thought I was done when I had my very first injection mold made for that cap piece, because that cap piece went literally over a hinge. And I was convinced that I could go to market with a Stanley hinge put through an aluminum leg if I just bought a mold, you know? So I guess my point is that, you know, once you finally get to the point where it tests out for you, you have to find a group. You must find a group of people that you trust. For me, I'm a tradesman, so I have many friends in many different trades. What I did was I picked five that I had known for years, five that I trusted, five that knew what I was doing and were willing to come along with me on the journey. That five dwindled down to probably three. And when I say dwindled, not out of that they didn't believe in it, but they weren't giving me the answers that I wanted to hear back. They weren't adopting the tool because their trade necessarily didn't involve as much pain as others. Their trade didn't involve as much pain as my trade or a concrete finisher's trade. So what I ended up finding eventually was three users, diehard users, that came along with me for about 4 years. And what I did is they became my best friends. I would build them units, deliver them to their sites. For example, this unit was built for a guy named Tali Finau, who was a concrete finisher for Kiewit Construction. And this was actually used on the construction of the 520 bridge. Tali is a boxer, a tough guy, and he's probably one of the most, in fact, I would not be here now without Tali, simply because, you know, Tali had the guts to walk on to a bridge with 40 other construction guys wearing this. And this is back when the arm did not come off, you know, you couldn't take the arm off. So that means that you're standing there with 20 other construction guys standing there with this ridiculous thing on your chest. Works amazing, but you got to have some self-confidence to be able to stand there and do that. And with Tali, he didn't care. He just simply said, I can do things that you guys can't do. I can work longer than you. Watch me. And that's where it began. Once you finally get out of that iteration and you have gone as far as you can possibly go with your materials and your skill, that's when you have to call an engineer and you have to develop a relationship with an engineer. That's what I did. And it's a whole nother story on how I was introduced to that engineer, but my engineer is up in Bellingham. His name is Tom Swedish. And the classic saying with Tom is, you know, one more change, Tom. Just one more tweak, Tom. And we've been saying that for 8 years now. And as I'm sitting here right now, it's evolving right now. I have somebody working on new chest plate foam right now. We're slightly tweaking that. I'm making one more change to my molds. We're introducing another product. It's always evolving. So hopefully I answered your question.
Yep, definitely. So Tali was really key to that human-centered focus during your innovation journey. Is there anybody else who was really critical, and how else did you maintain that really human-centered approach when you were developing your tool?
Thank you. Tali is on the concrete side of things. Real big guy, 275 pounds, different body type, large, imposing, top heavy, and not top heavy, but just there's no two body types the same. But if this guy fit a barrel chested wrestler, that's him. Now, on the other side of it, I still have a guy named Jeff Muggy. Went to high school with him. I have so much history with this guy. I got into the industry when he got into the industry, but he focused solely on tile. So when I invented this, he was one of the first people I brought it to. And just like Tali, he has been critical in bringing it along. For example, Tali told me that there had to be a lock on the arm. Said there must be a lock on this arm because it's unstable for me in many different positions. However, Jeff said that he would not use the lock. So at one point, I actually had a unit that was a locking unit and a non-locking unit. And then I was able to find out how to combine those two. But it was the two different voices of Jeff saying he didn't need it, Tali saying he wouldn't work without a lock, that you realize that though they're both incredibly good at what they do, they work differently. You know, their body types are different. They're engaged different in different static positions for longer than the other one is. So I took all of that information and I was able to take three separate versions. Number one, a locking arm. Number two, detachable arm. And then, you know, to be honest with you, removable foam and things like this. These are all iterations that simply came from requests from people saying that it had to be this way. So I was able to take all these different versions through the engineer and over the years combine them into one version. So now instead of three separate backups, we have been able to engineer all features of those into one. And so without Jeff, we couldn't have done that. Without Tali, we couldn't have done that. Tali told me when he was working on the 520 bridge that he took it off and it was so hot. He said, if there's any way that this could be breathable, you know, then you start drilling holes, you know, quarter inch holes. They're not big enough. They got to be 3/8. Half inch is too big, you know, hundreds of innovations that always come back to the user. That's it. Everything is about the user. So
the feedback was really critical in refining your product. How did you collect that feedback during the testing phase?
I collected it in a couple different ways. Obviously, in-person meetings. When somebody tells me something, for example, Boeing, for example, when I hear something in the field one time, it could be a one-off. It could be somebody just saying an offhand comment. However, when I hear something twice, my alarm bells just begin to go off. It is now something that needs to be listened to. And in fact, if I hear it twice, I will now start seeking out or trying to pull that information from people, such as the shoulder strap, for example. The shoulder strap used to be in a static location on the back. And then now that it is adjustable to triple extra large all the way to double extra small, that shoulder strap needed to be able to move. These are just these little iterations that, so I listen, I just listen. And I think that's really the biggest thing is that I listen, because if somebody is willing to tell me something and they're willing to go outside of their comfort zone in the smallest way to tell me a little tidbit of information, and if I hear that twice, that's real and that needs to be addressed and that needs to be thought of and integrated, or at least you need to learn more about what is being said. Shoulder strap, for example, last year the shoulder strap was always one hole on the left. I figured, hey, the whole thing weighs less than 2 pounds. It's not holding up weight. It is not a matter of weight coming down. The shoulder strap is the only reason is so that it doesn't work its way down. Well, I've heard from one person, I have a shoulder injury on my left side. I say, well, you may be one of 1,000 people that, you know, okay. Second time I heard it was at Boeing. Somebody said, I had a shoulder injury on my left side. Can this go to the right side? That was the second time. And I said, okay, there's something to this. Went back to Tali about a month ago. I've known Tali now for 10 years. Every time I have a new iteration, I hand deliver it to his home in Kent because he still works. And it's like Christmas Day every time I bring him a new one because I want to get the feedback from him. And so that's how I do it. This information is critical, but if somebody is willing to give you the information, you gotta listen. That's really what it's about, you know?
So really it's about that relationship is really that critical. You have to have the trust. They have to trust you in developing a solution and hearing the problems that they're raising. And you have to trust that they're being honest with you. I know I've taken a lot of new and emerging tech out into the field, and sometimes people want to tell you what you want to hear, and they're not always willing to kind of give you that hard truth that you really need to make a good product. What were some of the challenges you faced during that iteration process?
Getting back to what, recapping on what you just said is that, I never ran into so many, roadblocks with contractors because they saw that I believed it to the core. There's no question that I am 100% into this, 100%. And when I'm handing you something that the world has never seen, that does something for you that no device has ever offered to a worker, they know I'm serious. And they know how passionate I am about that. I have my life into this, and they know that. So right off the bat, they know that I'm serious. about asking them about what their experience is with it. I'm not wasting time. I'm not asking you for, you know, this reason or the other, but I'm serious as you are about the pain you're going through. That's how serious I am about it, because until you have experienced this kind of pain, like you don't know, like you don't understand until you've been there and in that position for 8 hours and you're really questioning your life decisions. Like, how did I get here? Like, what's the timeline on when I can master this so I can get to another level? And then when you come to the decision that, well, maybe this is the mastery, this is what I'm supposed to be getting good at, and this is just my path in life. It is what it is. And I say that you don't have to accept that. I didn't accept it. I didn't accept the fact that it's natural for me to be in that kind of pain. It's unacceptable. So what do? You come up with a solution. Getting back to that is that people know I'm serious when I'm talking about this product. They know it. And that translates right in reverse to them taking it serious and saying, this is how it works for me. This is how it could be better. Challenges, getting back to your challenges question. Yeah, a lot of challenges. You know, in the beginning, the challenges, it was fun. Building these things is fun, you know. For myself, they were fun. The challenges was the patent process. A large part of that challenge was the patent process. Financially, who do I go to? You know, when I started, I went to InventHelp. Remember that? You know, have you ever heard of InventHelp? You know, it's got that cartoon of a guy knocking a stone into a thing, and it's like a one size fits all patent process. You know, started there, and then realized right before I signed the contract for $5,000 that I looked at the products that they had, and there's no passion at all behind any of the products that they were showing me. And they were a little one. I know you'll probably edit that. Sorry, I don't mean to down talk a company, but it's all about passion for me. And I didn't feel like they had it, you know? And that's what it is. So the challenges, the prototyping, yes, but the patents are a real challenge, an incredible challenge, not just financially, but mentally. You know, the patent process, I thought you apply for a patent. You know, when you get your first denial, it shakes you up. You know, I was panicked. I was like, oh, what's going on? You know, and that was, I had one attorney, my first attorney. I called him and said, what's going on? What are we going to do with this? What are we going to do with this denial? And his question was, his answer was, I'm not sure, you know, let's get together and talk about it. And I just remember flipping out. I just remember thinking, you don't know the answer to this. Long story short, that was one patent attorney that I worked through. And then I finally was introduced to my now patent attorney, which I've had for 9 years. But that's the challenge, is staying positive during those times when you get the denial and when you have to question yourself and say, wow, is this ever going to happen? You know? And if it doesn't happen, you know, what am I going to do? You know? And so yeah, challenges, the innovating process and the patents. You know, it's funny thing about the patents, and I'll end this, is that, you have to keep innovating through the downtimes. You have to keep going, because what I found in the darkest, darkest moments when I thought I would not get a patent, all of my users were still asking me for new iterations. The releasable arm, the magical somehow arrive at a releasable arm, had still not been solved yet. So I just kept continuing. I just kept solving. Put all that stuff aside as far as the patents and all that. I just put it all aside and I said, you know what? Let's focus back on the users. That will work itself out eventually. I have to keep focusing on the users. And that was the key. Because for me, what ended up happening was I had two or three major breakthroughs. I was able to figure out the releasable arm. And because I did that, figured out the releasable arm, the lockable arm, the basic principles of what is now the backup. Nobody had ever done that. in history. Nobody had ever combined these things together in this certain way. And eventually that's what awarded me my patent, my first patent. And then I got four more, well, five more and more on the way. All because that perseverance is basically what it is. So thank you. I hope I answered that question.
Yeah.
I was, and sorry, Sarah, to jump in. I was just going to ask, because you're, I think it was a really good message that if you hear something once, you know, take note of it. When you hear something twice, then time to dig in a little bit deeper. But, and you talked about hundreds of iterations and ideas. How did you determine what didn't make the cut? Like, who was it? Was it you that was like, you know, this doesn't fit into the vision of what I want to do? Or was it, again, just implementing and trialing it and then ditching it if it didn't work?
It has to work for me, and it has to work flawlessly. You know, it has to be intuitive. You know, I read something one time, forgive me if I'm saying this wrong, but Occam's razor, you know, is a theory that basically says that if the process that has the least amount of steps will be the process that gets adopted. And that never left my mind and is with me to this day. If you can do something, if something can be done in two steps, but you're taking three and somebody offers you an option of taking two, they're going to take two because it's one less step. That's with me right now. That's with me. That's with my engineers. He's working on something right now because I see an opportunity to shave off 2 seconds of the user's what they have to go through in the experience. 2 seconds is literally, I am making a change that's going to cost me, you know, quite a bit of money, but it's in the direction of better use. Is anybody else doing that? I don't think so. I really don't think there is anybody else so focused on the end user as the way we are, because I am the end user, you know? And I know what I expect out of tools. You know, I want the best. And I'm willing to pay for the best. You know, there's a difference between skill saws and you can feel them in your hands. I believe it's the same thing true with quality in this kind of a tool. So I don't know if I answered your question, Scott. You know, iterations, which ones do I feel that the ones get adopted? They got to pass my litmus test first, because I'm a tradesperson and I'm pretty hardcore as far as hands-on. That would be the first test. Then I go to the people that I trust that will give me information without hurting my feelings. I don't care about that. Tell me what I'm missing here. And it's those moments that I really get enlightened. Those are the moments that I hear things that I totally did not hear. Things like chest plate foam, you know, things like the chest plate foam, for example, the original chest plate foam never, you can see how this is raised up here past the plane of the plastic. That's because, you know, I had users that were telling me the pinch point here is on the top hemisphere. Top hemisphere. How do you solve for that? Well, we 7 different foam iterations, we finally realized a simple solution of raising the foam up 1.5 inches past, so that when the user of any size engages and compresses, that it actually folds over. That simple detail made a world of difference in comfort. But you don't know that until somebody, until 2 or 3 times you hear it. It pinches here. It's uncomfortable here. So it's a never-ending evolution. And eventually, I will say, it is ending. For me, my challenge is when do you end? When are you good enough to hand it out to the masses? And that's a question that nobody can answer except the person inventing. If I didn't make that decision 1.5 years ago, this is a 9-year journey for me right now. 1.5 years ago, I started selling this. That's 7.5 years of patenting, evolving, 27 different versions of this product. You know, so the answer is it never stops evolving. And the users are what drive innovation. A lot of times I'll think, hey, I'm thinking, hey, I want to put a laser on this thing, and I want to do all this. And you have to stop and say, go back to the users, let them drive innovation, because otherwise you're just wasting your time. You know, you're wasting your time on things that you may think are good. Let them drive the innovation. Let them drive the solutions. So that's kind of what I think on that.
I think one thing that's unique about you is you are the end user, but you're also the inventor behind it. How has your process been different being that end user and really understanding the problem compared to a lot of other solutions on the market?
Oh, well, I can't speak for others. You know, what I would tell you is I know nobody works harder than me. I know that just because I've been doing it for so long. I grew up in a family business, and I was the youngest of two brothers. And my thing was how tough can you be? You know, how tough can you end up being? And then, you know, I'm sorry, Sarah, I got off track there. I lost
okay.
My train of thought. Could you ask me that question again?
Yeah.
Sorry.
So beginning that you're the inventor, but also the end user, how has that process been different than the typical evolution of a product where it's usually designed in maybe a laboratory or researchers and it's engineers coming up with a solution and then having to go to the end user for that feedback? How's your process been different being the end user and the inventor?
Rewarding, very rewarding. In that I knew I had the solution. Here, believe it or not, here works just as good as the newest one. But how much do you want to evolve is the question. I had people telling me back here that I could sell this at Home Depot. Back here, this is 6 years, 7 years ago. I did not believe that at that time. Doesn't mean that I didn't have the confidence to believe it, but I knew it was not there. And that's a hard place to be because you know you need to get there, yet you're not there. So you just keep evolving, and you have to keep using. I have logged thousands of hours using this device. Thousands. And you know, that's just not an exaggeration. It is just, there's no other way except through. And to fully understand a concept, you have to fully understand it. There's no other way. There's just no other way to arrive at the principles of what you're trying to accomplish is a landmark moment when I realized that the principles involved are not just an arm and a chest plate. That's not it. The principles involved are, is the user safe? Can the user get injured? How long can the user wear this for before they start feeling the effects of wearing it? Can that be lengthened? How can that be lengthened? I would say it's pretty intense. You know, I think you have to be incredibly passionate about it. Otherwise, don't even start. Honestly, because you're going to end up with a product that is subpar and will never be adopted because you weren't willing to go 100% the entire journey. And I think for me, I got to a point a year and a half ago, I finally had to say, I am ready. This is ready. And that's funny because I did a show, it was a big show, did the show, and I won't get into that story, but that was a landmark moment for me was that I was invited after that show from a government agency to a base. And I went on that base, I got all my clearances. I went in alone. I turned around in a big room and there was about 100 people there and kind of came out of nowhere. Next thing you know, they're Everybody's trying on my tool. I had lost control of the room a little bit. And then next thing you know, I have some 350-pound guy using the device not the way he's supposed to be using it. I turn around and I hear a click. I was talking to somebody. I knew he was behind me using it, and I heard a click. And I knew exactly what that click was that the device had broke. And it was a moment for me that took me back. And it was a tiny little hairline crack that had occurred in a critical part that was, I guess, a watershed moment for me. I left that meeting just leveled because I thought, here it is. I'm here, and this is this little thing happened, and this is not good. I was really depressed for a while, about 2 days, and then I got right back on my horse, went back to the drawing board, and within 2 months we made 14 fundamental changes to the device. Everything from quadrupling the strength of the part that broke, to re-engineering fundamental parts of the chest plate to make them stronger. The device tests out at 5 times stronger than when I went into that meeting. Now, had I gotten knocked over by that meeting, had I not been willing to rise from the challenge after that, I would not be here right now, and the product that I have would be inferior. But that was such a wake-up call, because I automatically had the people in place. I had the engineer in place. Went back to him, and how that works is I like to hand draw my stuff. I'm not that good on CAD. I like to hand draw. He translates it for me, and then he brings it back. He sends me a prototype of it. I'll test it. Then we make that change in the molds. That's how it works. So I don't know if I answered that question for you, but
yeah, I think your resiliency and adaptability really shines through your journey. And I think that's probably tied closely to that passion, but also really trying to solve your own problem. As we close, is there any advice you'd give to other aspiring innovators from the construction industry?
Absolutely. I would tell you to not try and be an innovator. Not because it's a long, lonely road, but people that try to innovate, I wouldn't let trying to innovate drive innovation. I know that sounds strange. What I would tell you is that you need to become incredibly good at what you do, whatever it is. If you're a tile layer, you need to be the best tile layer. If you're a concrete finisher, you need to be in that top 1%. If you are ever going to enjoy the fruits of your labor, to enjoy your life, you must be incredibly good at one thing in your life. But in becoming incredibly good at that one thing, that's where the opportunity lies. You must work harder than everybody else so that you can see things that nobody else see. You know, if I wasn't willing to work 12 hours a day and break my back and experience that level of pain, then I would not have come up with a solution to match that level of pain, because I would have never experienced that level of pain. I would have never had to come up with a solution because I had never put myself in that position. And the only way you can put yourself in that position is you must be willing to become the best at what you do. And it's when you're there, that's when you see opportunities for improvement in your field. That's the only way. That's the only way that I see it. You must become incredibly good at what you do. That's what opens up the opportunities, is when you have developed mastery. But mastery can take 10 to 15 years of a trade. So yeah, that's pretty much it. I'm passionate about it. I think you got to be incredibly good at what you do. Don't try to be an innovator. Get incredibly good at your niche. Because when you do that, that's when the opportunities arise. It's only through mastery, knowledge. And when you have that, Well, then everything just falls into place. You know, you might be gifted with a solution that you could have never thought of, but that only came from mastery. You know, you must be a master at what you do, and you must be willing to become a master at what you do. So.
Thank you for that advice. I think your heart is definitely in it. I think that's a key part of, right, that human-centered approach is that empathy. You understand the problem better than anybody because you experienced it firsthand. Thank you so much for taking us through your innovation journey, Bo. We really appreciated learning about the highs and the lows and also the perseverance that it took to get through the process. As we close today, I just want to invite listeners to go ahead and put any thoughts and feedback into the comment section on YouTube. We look forward to hearing your thoughts on this episode and your ideas for any future episodes. As we reiterate kind of that innovation journey, you did a great job of sharing how you really identified and understood the problem, that evaluation, that feedback process with other users to kind of collect the insights needed to be able to iterate on your design. And then you walked us through that solution phase of how you did the prototype development, how you did the testing and feedback, and then how you implemented and scaled your solution and how you knew you were ready to go prime time after 7.5 years. Thank you so much for your time today, and we really appreciated having you on today's episode.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll definitely include your contact information because I can only imagine there'll be a lot of people who want to reach out and learn a little bit more.
Yes, thank you. I would offer that just for this program, you know, if you go to our website and enter the code at checkout, HardHat324, HardHat324, it's a one-time 20% off discount for anything on our site. So thank you.
Cool.
Great. Thank you. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.